Hello, my dear sweet golems of the northern sun. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. I bow in your direction. Today's episode features the amazing Nick Kroll, who has an incredible show that is on Comedy Central right now called The Kroll Show. He's several seasons in. This is the last season. Nick Kroll actually had the guts to end a show prior to it being canceled, which is a really novel thing. A lot of times people let their show experience the same kind of life as their pet. They have a lot of fun with it, and then they keep it around a few years longer than maybe it needed to be because the poor little thing can barely walk, and it's peeing all over the floor, and anytime it moves, you could hear the remaining vertebrae, and it's rapidly disintegrating back, click, like an old lady's high heels walking through a graveyard. Nick Kroll had the guts to actually end his show and move on to brighter and better things. And he's a really cool guy, and it was nice to get to sit down with him. We're going to jump right into that. But first, I want to offer those of you who have seen American Sniper what I would consider to be an antidote for the diarrhea of propaganda that got sprayed into your mind by that movie. This is Charlie Chaplin, and it is from the movie The Great Dictator. But for those of you who went to American Sniper and sat in the audience and felt that sinking, horrifying feeling that comes from realizing that not only are you in the presence of some really hardcore, disgusting propaganda, but you're also surrounded by people who maybe aren't aware of the fact that they are getting hypnotized by the military-industrial complex, and that really you're not in a movie theater, you're at the very top of a water slide that could lead to your nearest recruiting office. That's a really creepy invasion of the body stat snatcher style feeling that happens when you're sitting in that theater. And this speech by Chaplin is the cure, the balm. And it is my wish to slowly and softly rub it into your heart chakra with my raspy lesbian voice. So here it is. Charlie Chaplin's famous speech from The Great Dictator. If you've already heard it, listen to it again. It's a really important thing to get this kind of information out into the world when a movie like American Sniper is actually doing good at the movie theaters instead of having the effect that you see at 3 a.m. at an underground warehouse rave in Los Angeles, which is causing people's eyes to roll back into their heads over and over and over again. Here it is, Charlie Chaplin from The Great Dictator.
We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men, with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate. The unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery. Fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power. The power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world. That will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
I think I've actually played that on this podcast before, so forgive me. I just needed to psychically gargle with that stuff after having Clint Eastwood's warmongering, bitter camo jizz sprayed all over my brain by that terrible movie. Okay, great. We're going to dive right into this excellent episode with Nick Kroll, but first, some very quick business. The Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is going on tour. I'm leaving for Texas tomorrow. I'm going to be in Austin on Friday. That show sold out, but I think they're going to release 15 tickets at some point tomorrow. So if you're somebody who did not get tickets for the Austin show at the Parish, keep your Twitter up, and I'm going to tweet as soon as I get the ticket link, but they're not putting the link up until tomorrow. I'm also going to be at the Come and Take It Comedy Takeover Festival, which is a really great comedy festival that's happening with some awesome comics like Maria Bamford and Todd Barry. Like, these are heavy hitters. These are legends and geniuses. They're going to be there in Houston, Texas, and I'm going to be there on the 24th, I'm doing stand-up, and I'm also doing a live podcast. So I'll be doing a stand-up there with Johnny Pemberton and Daniele Bellelli. You can get the tickets on my website, and it's cool because if you get tickets for the festival, you can see a lot of great comics too. So go do that. And also, if you're in Dallas, Texas, I'm going to be at the Sons of Herman Hall on the 25th with Johnny Pemberton. And this show is about 65% sold. So that means that it'll probably sell out. Don't wait to get tickets. Get tickets now by going to my website. God, it always feels so uncomfortable saying that. Get tickets today. I feel like a fucking mattress salesman or something. But it's there for you. I'll be there with Johnny Pemberton. Come hang out with us. There's a lot of other dates on the website for March. I'm going to be in Winnipeg, St. Paul, Madison, Chicago, and Columbus. And I also have some East Coast dates that are going to happen soon. I'm not sure if the ticket links for these are active because it's kind of into the future. But just to get you guys ready, I'm going to be in the Arlington Draft House in Arlington, Virginia. I'm going to be in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the Sinclair. I'm going to be at the Trocadero in Philadelphia. And I'm going to be at the Bell House in Brooklyn. You can go check out those websites. I don't know if the ticket links are up yet, but if you want to be super responsible and get something, tickets in advance for something that's happening in April, go do it now, because these shows do tend to sell out. Thank God. Thank you for making that happen and for giving me an incarnation where I can actually say that. Thank you for that. Okay, we are also sponsored by Amazon.com. If you go to the DuncanTrussell.com to the comments section of any podcast there, you'll see an Amazon link. And the next time you're buying something through Amazon, click on that link. It's a way for you to support this podcast without having to do anything more than buy some wonderful thing for your life from Amazon.com. And I would recommend the book Mindfulness by Joseph Goldstein. You can also get a free download of that by going to audibletrial.com/familyhour, signing up for a trial membership of Audible. Sorry for rushing through this stuff, guys, but I got to get packed for my tour, and I actually spent like 4 hours trying to record this intro and doing this really embarrassing, long, cliche-filled anti-war rant, and I listened to it, and I was so embarrassed to hear my raspy lesbian voice vomiting out the exact same thing that so many other I don't know if I have low testosterone. But I think if you heard my voice and had to bet, I have a feeling I know where your money would be. So I don't know, just something about listening to myself rambling on and on about something I think we all already know, which is that war sucks and we want it to stop, really, really embarrassed me. So I didn't just sit down to record this. I've been sitting here in my studio for hours trying to record it, and now I'm just going to upload it because I got to go on tour, and I'm not going to have time to put a podcast up this week if I don't get a podcast up today. So here we go. Let's dive right into this episode. Today's guest is the creator and star of The Kroll Show, which you can watch on Comedy Central. I have links to that at duncantrussell.com. He's also a super funny stand-up, and all Kroll-related links will be located in the comments section of this podcast. Everybody, now welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, Nick Kroll.
Here.
Thank you, my friend. These microphones, according to the box, were the same microphones, the same model used by Michael Jackson to record Thriller.
Really?
Isn't that amazing?
Because I was thinking, like, I remember hearing about a guy who had access to Al Green, like the microphone that Al Green used to do a bunch of his, like a guy in Memphis who had these like microphones that were very special.
Very special. I mean, and you know, with a podcast, you really want to capture the depth of your voice. Like,
that's what people are in it for.
You got a great voice, Nick Kroll.
I'm feeling it right now. It's I think I sound a little under the weather or something. There's a deep, rich, velvety timbre to it right now.
You've got a serious velvety timbre.
You have a beautiful voice, but it's a higher pitched
voice. It's a raspy lesbian trucker voice, but I appreciate it. I've come to terms with my crap voice. It's just an embarrassment.
Your voice matches your face.
Oh, thank you. You know, that's interesting because some people say it doesn't. Some people think when they hear my voice, they think of like a woman with like a middle-aged woman with short hair who smokes.
Really?
So that's cool, man.
Well, it's always when you listen to the radio or podcast, you're like, what does that person look like? Because oftentimes you don't know. And I'm always like, because sometimes radio voices are so sexy or whatever that you're like, ooh, I bet she's so beautiful, or I bet he's a real handsome guy. And then you see him and you're like, oh, it's just like a balding weirdo with a big fat tummy.
Yeah.
You're neither of those.
Oh, not yet.
You're fit.
Not well, mildly fit. But Nick, thank you so much. Yeah, that's a curious thing. And also, it's the same thing as sometimes when you see a person who has a very beautiful body, but inside there's just maggots.
Yeah, yes.
But the maggots cover up love, not to be completely negative.
It's just
there's
true.
Sometimes a layer of maggots.
The maggots are feasting on the love inside?
That's a very interesting question. Yeah, I think the maggots are feasting on the thing that the desperate resistance to just being sweet. That's what I hope. But maybe people are nasty all the way down.
Oof. I think there are a couple real nasties to the core.
Really?
But I don't think many, or I've chosen to look at people who I find to be either shitheads or mean or monsters or whatever, that like all of that is manifested from a place of self-hatred.
Right.
And so if at least you don't have to like them, but at least you can pity them.
Right. Which is way, way worse than being mean to them.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I remember somebody, I don't remember who said it, but they said the worst insult that you can give a person is to feel sorry for them. There's nothing worse. Yeah. You know, because it's like if you just tell someone, you suck, you're a cunt, you're kind of at their level.
Right.
But when you're like, man, I really feel bad for you.
Yeah. People are like, oh, God.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
It's very similar to when someone comes up to you and asks you if you're, are you okay?
Oh, interesting. You're like, oh, yeah. Why? Do I seem not okay?
Yeah. And that'll ring in your head for days. Like, oh my God, what is it that I did? Like, I know, because we all kind of feel a little not okay all the time.
Oh, yeah. We're all on the verge.
All on the verge of what?
Throwing ourselves off a fucking bridge.
Yeah, that is true. I love that you freely say that. I think that's a real like gift to the world. Just to, if everyone just would admit, like, hey, guys, we're all completely on the precipice of throwing ourselves into oblivion. People would feel so much less inclined to act like everything's okay.
Yeah, I'm shocked. I'm shocked. I'm shocked that more people aren't killing themselves.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, I wish it were a joke because I won't. I'm flirting with material that I'm working on,
okay.
But it's because I'm thinking about it a lot. Which is, I have an amazing life, and yet I'm still quite. I think I'm actually a pretty relatively happy person, but there are still a lot of times where I'm like, "What are we doing? What am I doing here? What are we all doing here?
Yeah,
like this is either boring or super sad."
Right.
Like, what is the point of this? And I'm not telling anybody to go do anything to themselves unless they tape it and I can jack off to it. But
the worst fetish. That is the most expensive fetish because, like, you have to get a prostitute to kill herself.
Oh, fuck.
Because it's not good enough to kill. It wouldn't be good enough to kill the person. That's not what you get off on. You actually need to find someone about to kill themselves.
And if the lighting's not – because I don't want to watch it live. I need to see a video of it so I can replay it. You know, like, I don't want to be there live. And it's not I'm not as scared of being caught. It's more just – I don't know. It's something about – it's tied to internet porn for me. I need to see it in like a 4x6 screen.
What would be the name of that kind of porn? You know, like when you're looking at porn, there's always that the genre list that represents all possible fetishes.
Yeah. I mean the obvious would be like there are the suicide girls.
So it's like the real suicide girls.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. Jesus. They would be like the Real Housewives.
Yeah. Well, you know, that would be – it's only – I think the reason that is such a suicide in general or jerking off someone committing suicide is like such a horror to imagine is because we don't know what happens.
Yes. Correct.
But, you know, if we knew that on the other side of death was some kind of expansive, free anything you can think you can have, traveling through time, ecstatic, nirvanic bliss state.
Yeah.
This planet would have such a very low population density. Like,
right. No, everyone would be like, oh, let's get out of here.
It'd be like Detroit. It'd be like a place that maybe you accidentally have to drive through, but you don't want to hang. Like, you'd be like, oh, what are you doing? Why are we here?
Yeah.
It would, not many people would be here, I would reckon.
I would think. I was in Detroit last winter. Doing a show, and I went out for a drink with a guy who I knew who lived, I think, in Ann Arbor, but knew Detroit. And it was truly, I mean, it's truly like desolate,
yeah.
You know, but and snowing at night. And we're driving, you know, we're going, and he's like, I'll take you to like a distillery, you know, because that's the thing is now that like hipsters are moving in and starting their like distilleries and art spaces
right.
and stuff. So it was like this cool bar, but in the middle of, I mean, like Armageddon,
right.
post-apocalyptic. It's intense.
The first American ruin is what Detroit is called.
Really?
Yeah, the first – it's a ruin.
Oh.
Yeah, it is. I've been there. I went to Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle. You ever performed there?
No, how was it?
It was terrible.
Was anybody there?
Well, see, you know, when I went to perform there, this was before I had started like – really podcasting. Mm-hmm. This is in the very beginning of it. So now when I go to shows, I get fans from the podcast, and it's beautiful. And
shout out to the fans.
Hello, fans. But the at that time, it was just like, you know, that where you get the random roll of the dice when you're doing comedy.
Sure.
That thing at a comedy club. So it's like some cool people, some people you're not sure of. And then there's the table of disabled elderly veterans that decided to come to a comedy show.
And they can't wait. They can't wait for your demonic puppetry.
Yeah, exactly, man. And that comes out, and you just feel bad for yourself, and bad for them, and bad for the whole.
Yeah, you're like, because you can't be angry with them. You're like, you're not my demo. I'm so sorry that you have to. I know that you're not going to like this. It's not your fault, but I'll also become insecure and angry with you for it.
Yeah, exactly. It's not. It is. I do kind of blame them in the sense that, like, if you go to see a movie, you at least look at like, well, what is this movie like?
Right.
But comedy is different from that in the sense that you're just like, oh, I'll just go see a comedian.
Yeah, man, I couldn't deal with touring that way early on. I was like, I'm not going on the road until like I can fucking have people know who I am. Wow. When I go on the road.
How long have you been doing comedy?
I started in 2002, I guess, really. Mm-hmm. Like, I moved to New York and started doing open mics and taking class at UCB. So, and I was doing stand-up, but I was doing real, you know, kind of alt stand-up and character stuff, and didn't really start focusing on doing stand-up in a real way till, you know, probably like 05, 06 or something. You know?
Oh, wow. And when did the thing start? When did you start feeling the momentum that, like, stuff was taking off for you?
I don't know. I mean, I think, like, I don't know. Because I feel like, you know, it's all these, like, markers. Like, I feel like careers are all these, like, weird little internal markers. Like, I remember there was a show in New York called Invite Them Up, which was, like, a big alt show that Eugene Merman and Bobby Tisdale ran. And it was, like, the cool, booked, weirdo show. It was, like, doing, like, Comedy Death Ray in L.A. And I remember getting booked on that and being more nervous to do that show than I was to do, you know, Kimmel.
Yeah.
You know? And so...
Because those alt shows can be... Just because in your mind, you look at those... Like, if those guys don't like you...
Yeah.
Then there must be something wrong with
you. Sure, but I had the same thing. I didn't go to the store. I didn't go to the Comedy Store until... Ran Azizi, you know, who was like a homegrown, I mean, I think you came up with him there, like, was a homegrown guy, and like, we were on the league together, and then like, I got invited to the store, but I wouldn't step, I was scared shitless to go do a set there.
Wow.
Like, it's all the unknown. Wherever you are, it's the unknown. It's like doing a set, doing a show still, like, if I were doing a set at a random place on the road now, and it wasn't like a show of mine, I'd be fucking freaked out.
Wow.
You know, because you're just like, and then also doing shows on the road now, where it's like, it's my show, it's like, shit, now there's an expectation for what I'll do. You know, it's just like, you know, you can, at least, there's a lot of, like, I've now had access to some very, very interesting, powerful, very successful people in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And they're all – everyone's insecure and wants to kill themselves.
I love that you're saying that. And it is true. And you know what it means, man? I think that means that you respect the audience and that you respect what you're doing. Because I, the day that I'm not nervous about performing, that's a bad day. Like, if I'm sitting there and I have a show coming up and I don't feel butterflies or worried or freaked out, that means something's wrong. Yeah. That means I'm numbed.
Yes. You're just cruise control.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that's a real thing. And I think it makes it also, it's like, it's a bummer when you see people like who are touring or doing a show, you know, or on a show, and they're just like checked. And good, you know, God bless them. People have to do their job and make a living. But it's a bummer because, like, we got into doing all this because it's like this weird, crazy, fun, creative thing that we get to do. You know? And then when it just becomes this, like, nah, I'm going to go cash the paycheck, you're like, oh, that's a bummer.
But you are in a really special segment of the comedian population in the sense that you've had this very successful show that's been going on for a while, two shows going on at the same time. And so you've gotten to experience what would be considered the upper echelon of what can happen for a comedian. Like outside of Louis C.K., Dane Cook level, super rock star, which you're probably approximating
that. Oh, I'm hugely.
But close, man, because you have the – so you're like up in the very upper echelon of that pyramid. And, man, I would imagine that is a pretty pressurized place to be because there's this – every bit of success a person gets, there's this extra notch that goes up on the expectation level, you know? And also, every level of success you get, the little stumbles when you were coming up and people didn't know you can seem more like big stumbles, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that – I honestly believe it's all relative and it's all scale. It's all the same shit. Like, again, you know, the success – like, wherever you are, like – there's someone who has the career that you want.
Right.
So whether it's like, you know, like if it's with no knowledge about this and like, you know, I'm like, you know, I'm sure there's like someone, Louis is like, fuck man, why don't I have his shit?
Right.
You know, like Chris Rock comes out with Top 5 and it pops.
Right.
I'm sure Louis's like, you know, like, I got my show, but I want a movie like that. Right. And I'm sure Chris Rock is like, fuck, man, Zach Galifianakis gets to go make, like, all these kinds of movies, and Zach is like, shit, you know, like, I mean, it's like, I think at every level there is this expectation that you're not accomplishing, you're not where you want to be. And maybe that's, and maybe there aren't, it's not always that case, but I think that one, that it can be the engine that drives you to, is the engine for ambition. I'm struggling with that right now of like, what is ambition and what is insecurity, if that makes sense.
Cool, yeah.
You know what I mean? So totally. Like, if you are feeling insecure about yourself, it drives you, it can either depress you down or it can drive you to succeed further.
Right.
Because you're restless, because you want more, you know?
Yeah.
But it also means that wherever you are, you're not quite enjoying whatever it is that you've achieved, you know? So it's funny to hear you say that about me, and it fully makes sense. Like, I have two shows that have worked that are people seem to like, and
people love it.
Yeah, and which I'm very grateful for, and I'm like, well, but I think I'm done. I feel like I'm creatively done with my show, so I'm gonna move on to the next thing. And then all of a sudden you're like, shit, did I just throw away the height of my relevance? Have I walked away? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Is this like, why am I walking away? But I'm like, well, I did it because I was feeling like I accomplished what I wanted to accomplish and the kind of show I wanted to make. And but I, there is the other side of that of like, fuck, like maybe that's the most hubris. That's filled with hubris to walk away from something that is working.
No, I think it's faith to walk away from something that's working, and that it's an acknowledgement that you exist in a universe of abundance, and that as long as your intentions are correct, you're going to get rewarded in ways that you can't possibly imagine. That's what walking away is. And that part of your brain that's like, fuck, that's it, man. Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
What are we going to do now?
Yeah.
That's the part of your brain that is the same part of the squirrel's brain. When you see it freaking out, scampering around looking for the next nut,
yeah,
that part of your brain, if you let it drive your life.
It's ironic. I went to the doctor and it turns out I do have a squirrel brain.
There you go, bud.
Yeah.
That's that thing that it's bean counting, man. It's like, you know, ambition, I think is, I think a lot of words in our language and in all languages just need to be reinvented because there's too much bullshit attached to all of them. Because when you hear ambition, I think it's either got some like positive connotations if you're going to business school or some negative connotations if you're an artist, but it's just a weird, stupid word, I think. And insecurity, it's a great question, ambition versus insecurity. Well, to me, it's like, you know that moment where you're in rhythm with the universe and everything's just working out and you feel like I don't know, like some kind of like Norse god pounding away at a sword or something. Like you're just the engine of creativity is just popping in your life and your sole focus or most of your focus is just on allowing yourself to be a conduit to this thing that's growing out of you for some reason that you can't understand.
Every once in a while, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Every once in a while. It doesn't happen all the time, but God damn it, when that happens, what's better than that?
Nothing.
That's like making out with Jesus. It's like the greatest feeling. There's nothing like it.
Yes.
That feeling. That, if you stay right there, no matter what happens to you, or if you have the intention of getting into that place, no matter what happens to you, you're already getting the big paycheck because that nothing can buy that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is just trying to approximate or fake that you're in that state, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe insecurity is the more insecure you feel, it's more of a – you can't feel insecure. Okay. When you're on stage having the greatest set of your life, think of if you can remember the greatest set you ever had.
Mm-hmm.
You don't feel insecure, right?
No. You're surfing. You're surfing the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that's ambition. Maybe that could be what you would call ambition. It's being just that explosive volcano of whatever is inside of you. You just blast in creativity jizz all over the tits of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive me for saying that. But the other but when you're on stage –
Who are you asking for forgiveness for in that?
What?
Who are you asking for forgiveness?
Okay, so I have in my mind like a cast of critics.
Uh-huh.
And so that was a That critic was like somebody who writes for Salon.com. Uh-huh, not that anyone listens to this shit from Salon.com. Right, right. But that was a
Slate.
That was a Slate feminist.
Yeah.
That I was apologizing to because it was such a misogynistic thing.
Well, but I would say that, I mean, you're possibly right, but, you know, there, I know a lot of girls who don't mind having, getting cum on their chest in a loving way. And I maybe now I'm courting the critic who's just like typing about you is like, huh? Hold on, I got a real scoop now. But I mean that if I can, I could equate the same analogy to you of like two people making love when you're surfing it right, and it's like, yeah, I'm gonna fucking blow on your chest, like, because we're so in this together, like, and like you can fucking squirt all over my face, like whatever it is, like, do you know what I mean? Like we are surfing this rhythm together, and it is finding those rhythms, and I think you're right, and there are a few sets like that. Every once in a while, it feels electric. And sometimes, every now and again, life feels that way.
Yes.
And it's a difficult thing. Is like trying to you can create the framework for that ability. You can like build that surfboard and try to get to the wave at the right time, right? But like. I don't surf, but I'm assuming there are a lot of mornings where people go out and they're like, fucking surf sucked today.
Yes.
Even though I set it all up, like even though the swell was supposed to be gnarly or whatever the fuck they say.
Well, yeah. No. And there it is that. I love that you say constructing the surfboard because I think that's like all the work you put into to it and get in like figuring out the right places to go to catch that swell. But the hunter, because you're surfers – are a form of – they're like a hunting like phenomena. They're hunting waves, right? But it's still a form of hunting.
Yeah.
You're like putting yourself in the right place to catch a thing which happens to be a goddamn swell of water that's being pushed by some kind of bizarre gravitational field I don't understand at all. But the in a comedian, it's the same kind of thing. But, you know, hunters that we'll talk about – hunters are weirdly similar to smokers. And the smokers aren't – it's not just the cigarette that they like.
It's the packing.
It's like going outside.
Yeah.
It forces you to go outside. And a hunter, it gives you something to do while you're wandering in the wilderness. And I think in this case, like if there's a way to figure out how to make even the moment preceding catching that wave just as special.
Mm-hmm.
If you just keep – what I mean is you just – if you're a surfer – and you're going out to surf that fucking wave because you know somebody's filming you and you want to look good, that's going to be a shitty day compared to the day where you're floating out there with your friends just waiting. That's a cool, awesome day. So it's that thing, right? It's like doing it for the moment, for the moment itself. I think if you keep it there, everything else works out.
Yeah, I hope so. I think that is the – it is, although I would say if you have a lot of ambition, that it's those people, the people who succeed on a crazy level in our society are very mapped out with what they're doing. They're not just going with the flow of it.
Oh.
Or they are going with their flow of it. Do you know what I mean? It's like their surfing is like, I'm scheduling beginning of the day to the end of the day, and I'm gonna have figured out like who's attached to my movie by the end of the day.
Wow.
Or do you know what I'm saying? Like I was talking to a friend of mine who's a very successful chef, like a fucking game changer chef and businessman. And he's just like, I was talking to him the other day and I'm like, ooh, this motherfucker is on a real – he is like on some real like I'm taking my failures, I'm turning them into success.
Wow.
I'm doing all of these things. I'm no longer even in the kitchen because I'm running this and that and that. And it was exciting. It was really inspiring talking to him. He's a killer in a way that I'm not necessarily. Like I'm a like, you know, there's every profession or like comedians, it's like, you know, they're killers. Do you know what I mean? Those dudes who are like, No, fuck that. I'm taking this and I'm taking that.
Yes.
Do you want to do my shit? No, then go fuck you. You know what I mean? And or they're not even unpleasant about it, but they're just, they fucking are killers. They go on stage, they're going to murder that audience that night. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Other people are like, you know, I'm going to do new stuff. I want to get this right. And like, also, this guy's got to follow me and I don't want to fucking try to get a standing O tonight because like it's going to fuck up their whole night. Other people are like, no, 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 no. You know? And I guess you have to respect them for surfing their night. You know?
I know what you're talking about. It's like people who are existing in life like they're at the Super Bowl or something and they're in this kind of like, I just was passing, I was going to get my beard trimmed and pass some poster for a show on, I don't know what the show is, but it's apparently about, I don't know, there's a picture of some like black dude and his hot wife and she's kind of like, you see his back but he's looking to the side and she's holding him and he's like, he runs the music industry and anyone who crosses him will pay that thing, which is which is a kind of capitalist archetype, which is this, it's the Michael Douglas Wall Street version,
Tony Soprano, it's all of it,
that thing, no one gets in my way, I rise to the top, you're sweating through the day, you're making these weird phone calls that involve saying yes and no, and the no people are suffering and the yes people are profiting.
Yeah.
So that kind of like that weird, and those people generally will become like the nucleus of this bizarre vortex of sycophants and stuff. Like they'll always have this insane orbit of, oh God, I've seen that shit, man. That's wild.
Well, and it's in real life, and then it's also, it seems to be basically the only thing people want to watch in a dramatic series. So it's like the anti-hero who you're like, look at that monster, like was Soprano, Walter White or Don Draper to, you know, it's Empire, Terrence Howard. Yeah. That's the new show. And it is. It's just like these fucking monsters who you somehow identify with. You're like, oh, I understand why he's, you know, such a monster. But but it's intense. It's not, and it's like, do you want to be that person, you know?
Do you want to be that?
I don't, but I want the trappings of their success.
You can have you know what, man? I think that that's a trick, is people like to make you think that if you're going to like have this kind of glorious ascent and have all the material trappings and all the stuff that goes along with it, you have to be like that.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either.
I don't think so. Your chef – though, he doesn't sound – he just sounds kind of hopeful and awesome and organized. Mm-hmm. You know, I ran into fucking John Jones. You know John Jones? There's a UFC. He's this fighter in the UFC. Uh-huh. And he was the title – whatever they call it. The main – I'm not a sports guy. Yeah. Title card. What do you call it? The main champ.
Yeah, yeah. So I like the main champ.
But, man, like, you know, whenever you get around – you get to be around somebody like that, some part of your brain, like the record button turns on because you're like, let me observe this rare being to see what's going on. And sweetest fucking guy, man.
Right, of course.
He's, like, standing at the – he's, like, came over to Rogan because we're doing shows with him in Vegas. He's talking to him. Like, I don't – obviously have no idea who he is, and I would not expect him to, like, say anything to me or anybody. But he was like, what's your name? Going around the tail saying hi to everybody in a sincere way, very sweet, saying to Joe, you know, I've done everything I can to get ready for this. If – like, he was saying what he was going to do in the fight, which was really interesting. He was going through his tactics. He was saying, like – I'm going to throw the guy like three or four times if I can because the guy had never been thrown before. But he was like, you know what? If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. And I've done everything I can do.
Wow.
Totally relaxed. Next night, this guy who was the joke, man. This guy was like radiating a kind of sweetness that comes out of like folks I meet at spiritual retreats, like Ram Dass and like, you know, people. He was his exact vibe. And he's like viciously just
– yeah.
Beating this guy into a bloody fucking pulp, lifting him up, threw him like three times. And so that guy's literally a killer.
Yeah.
But yet he seems to be living his life in a very sweet way. Yeah. So I think
Did he win?
He won.
Oh, good. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. He fucking won. And it was glorious to watch. It was glorious because you're like, oh my God, this is a guy who was just this.
He had his intention and he delivered on it.
Yeah, and I think the trick that gets played on people by these motherfucking shows is that you begin to think like, God, if I'm going to be like – if I'm going to have this real success, I better start stabbing some backs, cutting some throats, and hurting some feelings. I don't know if it's true.
No, I don't think so. My experience also, like, having the biggest bummer about my the putting Kroll show to bed is, like, is truly, like, this last season, the vibe on set and the crew was so good. Like, it was it was such, like, everybody was looking around being like, this is fun, and we like each other, and this is a great way to spend your day.
Yep.
You know, and that was, like, that's the biggest bummer, is to be like, am I breaking apart a team? And I think a lot of these people have worked together and will continue to work together, and I hope to work with a lot of them again too. But it was that thing of, like, shit, like, this was a really functional machine here. This was a lot of people working very nicely together. No assholes. Like,
but,
you
Nick,
know?
I gotta say, man, it's just, to me, it is such an honorable, beautiful thing that you did, which is that you ended a show. It wasn't canceled. It wasn't going downhill. Mm. You ended it just because you were ready to move on.
Mm-hmm.
Now that, to me, is a real is a beautiful thing. And you have to trust that, just like things are going to be fine for you, things are going to be fine for the team that was surrounding that show.
Yeah.
But if you continue to do something, if you continue doing whatever it is that you're doing, especially when it comes to comedy, because it's a money-making device or a survive. If you keep, God, get ready for a fucking stupid hippie thing. But, brother, if you keep functioning from your first chakra, you know, you never.
What's that? To explain that.
Survival. So the first chakra is, like, at the like, basically right between. It's your taint.
Uh-huh.
It's right between your balls and your asshole.
Yeah,
that's the first chakra, and the first chakra is where the idea is energy is moving up from the earth into the sky, which it is, and energy is moving down from the sky into the earth. So there's a cycle that happens, and so the earth energy, the first energy conduit it touches when it goes into your body, is the first chakra,
right?
And that's all survival based. So when you find yourself, like, waking up in the morning and worrying about money, or if you find yourself worrying if you're, you know, you're gonna lose your girlfriend or your house, whatever it, whenever you're caught in that kind of mental place, they say your energy, you're focused on the first chakra, and the idea is to, like, push that energy to move the blocks so that it'll, like, flow up through all the other chakras. Try to get up to the third or fourth at least,
and up and out.
Up and out.
And where are the rest of the chakras? They all run up the center of your body?
So the second one, I'm going to fuck this up, but so it's like it goes up through the center of your body. The second one's your, like, sex. The third one is power. I believe the fourth one is love. The fifth one is communication. The sixth one is intellect, I think. And I believe the seventh one is, like, the pure mystical potencies.
And you should be functioning from all of them.
Well, you know, you go through all those throughout the day. You're probably going to go, like, going to cycle through all of them or most of them. You know, you're, like, you're going to, as a comedian, definitely you're going to be, like, figuring out ways to articulate how you feel.
Yeah.
And then, but you'll notice, like, there's a kind of behind everything that you do, there's this general sense of, like, you know, what you're saying, like, God, fuck, I always feel like I'm on the verge of killing myself, you know? So it's like the water is always going to be a little murky if you've got energy blocks in there. And theoretically, I don't know from experience, but if you, like, remove those energy blocks, then that underlying sense of being, like, on the precipice of suicide at all times goes away.
Yeah, yeah.
That underlying sense is just a feeling of having, like, your energy kind of imbalanced.
Yeah, and just to preface, I don't want to belittle the idea of suicide in that, you know, like, I'm using it as a term of, you know, of general ennui and hopelessness, but leading towards that, you know what I mean?
We all think about suicide, man. I think so many, I think it's one of the most, I don't think you're belittling it. I think you're just removing the taboo of, like, because a lot of people don't understand that suicidal thoughts are, if you have half a brain and you exist in a dimension, which according to Buddhism is, one of its primary characteristics is suffering, then you're going to think of every single way that you can reduce the suffering. And one of the most obvious results
is
kill yourself.
Yeah.
So for one of the, like, if you typed into a computer, if I'm in water and I don't want to be wet, what are some things I could do? The computer's going to write back, get out of the water. Mm-hmm. In the same way, if suffering is one of the primary characteristics of the existence that we're in, obviously get out of this life. Fucking dimension, mm-hmm. and perhaps you'll stop suffering.
So do you think that there is whatever after this? Do you think there's something after this?
Well, I mean, yeah, I do think that for sure. Do you?
I don't know. I have not thought much about the afterlife. Mm. I don't have any sense of it. I have not troubled myself to focus on it too much.
Smart. That's because you're smart. And that was, you know, they were always asking Buddha, like, what happens when we die? And mm-hmm. he's like, you really don't need to worry about that right now. He was like...
He's like, guys, come on.
That's like worrying about laundry that you need to do 50 years down the road.
Right.
No point in thinking about that because it's not really going to, like, it's not going to alter your moment-to-moment
right.
state of existence. And that's the start there, which is like, how do I feel? Mm-hmm. Don't worry about what happens when I die. The first thing to ask yourself is, how do I feel most of the time? Mm-hmm. And then instead of trying to make that really, like, nuanced, just think, most of the time, do I feel pleasant or unpleasant? Mm-hmm. Simple question. Most of the time, do I feel pleasant or – like in the day, mm-hmm. if every moment could be categorized as a pleasant or unpleasant feeling, mm-hmm. when there's like scales and the unpleasant goes on one side, pleasant on the other, where are the scales in my life?
Yeah.
For most people, it's unpleasant. It's pretty unpleasant. So the hopeful idea in Buddhism is that you can actually – get those scales to
right.
to balance out so that they're not on either side.
To keep it balanced, not more pleasant than unpleasant.
Yeah, I think that's kind of it. It's called the middle way. So
is it because you're just like, if you're trying to be pleasant all the time, you're searching too hard or you're just trying too hard or what?
Well, it gets pretty weird, man. It's like pleasant and unpleasant, for either of these experiences to happen, it requires an observer to be aware of the pleasant and unpleasant state. Uh-huh. And so most people have attached themselves to the pleasant and unpleasant state as an identity. So they think, I feel bad, therefore I am bad. Mm-hmm. But really, it's in the same way that you can look at this table right now. I see a table, and you don't think I am that table. In the same way, the reality of thought and feeling is that since you are only a field of awareness observing the feeling, you can't be it.
Uh-huh.
So Buddhism is just trying to disentangle you from your attachment to identifying with your feeling states and recognizing your true identity.
Which is a woman.
Yeah. Which is a woman with jizz all over her face and tits.
Oh, what a dream.
What a dream.
Do you think it's all a dream?
This?
Yeah.
Yes, I do. I think a lot of people think when they wake up in the morning they've actually woken up, and they haven't. They're still dead asleep, because as long as your life consists of habituation, mm-hmm. habitual, like, anything, then you're pretty much dead asleep. Like, just like the next time you go buy something, this is a very fun experiment that you can do. Watch the way you buy something.
I've realized recently when I buy stuff, I get on my phone and start looking at my phone as I'm paying.
There you go.
Like as if it's like I'm ignoring the final stage of this process.
That's
it. Transaction.
So watch that. Don't change it. Watch it. And it's really awesome to start watching yourself go through all the like habitual things that you do. Watch the way you open your car. Watch the way you put your seatbelt on. Watch the way you start the car. Mm-hmm. Watch the way that you buy groceries. Watch the way you unload groceries. Watch the way you watch TV. You start watching yourself and you realize, oh my God, almost everything I do is a kind of weird thing I figured out a long time ago, like how to do it. Like mm-hmm. I'm not putting any thought to it at all.
And that's the interesting thing about being in a relationship, I think, is when you start to date someone and you spend a lot of intimate time with a specific person, you are watching them and seeing their thing of like, that's how she makes coffee, or that's how, you know, and it's a weird thing to, and also to know that you are being watched as well.
Damn right. And also usually in a relationship where shit gets weird, or for me it does, is where instead of like watching myself,
you start watching the other person.
I start watching the other person, and instead of like watching myself and analyzing why I'm doing what I'm doing, I'm watching them and like, what the fuck would they do that? When it's, because it's easier.
Yeah.
It's easier.
Yes,
but,
it is.
But the dream thing, man, I love that question, because it's really fun to watch what happens when you aren't paying attention. Watch what happens in your life. Like, how does a house get messy?
Mm-hmm.
How does your house get messy? It's a great question. Mm-hmm. How did this shirt get here? These mm-hmm. socks get there? Whatever. When your house gets messy, usually it's because you're in a hurry or because you haven't been paying attention. And this weird zombie-like version of you has been like going around your house, throwing shit everywhere
mm-hmm.
while you're up in your head or staring at your phone. You're mm-hmm. not there at all. But if you start watching yourself, you'll notice the house a little will naturally just start becoming clean because you finish the cycle. You take stuff out and you mm-hmm. put it back. Mm-hmm. So your whole life starts transforming if you just stop sleepwalking.
Right.
You know? So,
which
yeah,
is a great plug for Sleepwalk with me, Mike Birbiglia.
God! Nick, shit, man. I think we got off track a little bit. I wanted to finish complimenting you because
yeah, and I think I was probably getting ready to deflect it, feeling like because what I started to feel like was like, why am I'm making Duncan? I'm now making Duncan compliment me.
No,
for
no,
this,
no, no, not making me. Yeah. You know, when you came over mm-hmm. when and we were talking, and you said that you just decided to stop the show. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that. I didn't know exactly the reason that it was stopping, but I didn't realize that you were making the ballsiest move that a person could make, which is that you are going to, for the sake of art, turn off a money fountain, an ego fountain, a career fountain, and move in the direction of freedom. That is unprecedented. I have not heard of anyone doing that in comedy. I don't know how often that happens. I don't think that happens that much, especially after the – how many seasons did you do?
Three.
Especially after three fucking seasons.
Mm-hmm.
That's a BBC move. I've always respected the BBC.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they just stop.
Yeah, that's the idea. It's like this, that was my feeling. It was like the English shows are just like, yeah, this is the best. Like The Office, the English Office was 12 episodes. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And not that the American Office wasn't a very good show, but it's like in those 12 episodes, we are left with the same feeling that we were with like 100 episodes of The American Office.
Yes. And you're left – God damn it, man. You're left with that like – there's that feeling of sadness when mm-hmm. you realize this is actually the last episode of a show.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love that feeling. That is such a great – that means that you have – that's like a relationship. You've had this beautiful relationship yeah. with the show, and yeah. then it's just – it's gone.
Yeah.
That's so much better than the endless strobing of the exact same bullshit over and over again until people are sick of it or the network's like, get the fuck out of here. It's just – it's over.
Yeah.
What you did was badass. What you did was a kind of like – I don't know, man. It's like Hendrix dying in the fucking you know what I mean? It's that thing. You, instead of letting your show
mm-hmm.
turn into a fat old thing that used yeah. to be what it was.
Instead of letting it become Santana.
You put your show to sleep.
Yeah. That is, I said, that is the way I've been described, as I put it to bed. Yeah. It's just put it to bed. So we'll see. But I feel very good about the show and I also think, you know, yeah. I would love to say that it was entirely a power – I'm looking just around the room – entirely a power play. And then – but they're also – part of that decision is made out of not pure confidence but out of insecurity. Do you know what I mean? It's a combination of being like, no, I'm putting it to bed because I'm ready for the next adventure. But the other side of that is – and not knowing anything about Buddhism but assuming if there's you know, a constant – that constant balance of – whatever you were saying of pleasantness and unpleasantness
yeah.
of the other side of that is like, I want to put this show away before people stop liking it.
Mm. Yeah, that's exactly what that's,
but that's a fear based decision as well as a power based decision.
Yeah, but it's still, I mean, it's like there, yeah, I guess it's fear based, but it's, yeah, I know what you mean. I just think it's like, I'm not going to keep serving this meal.
Yeah.
If I think I'm going to serve this recipe or whatever this yeah. meal is yeah. a certain amount of times, I'm going to make a new meal.
Yeah. That's the
goal.
Because
I'm a fucking chef and I make new stuff too.
That's the goal.
And you challenge yourself too. I can't remember who said this, but they said from time to time, you need to kick the ant's nest over and let the ants rebuild a new nest. And when you do that, you get more and more beautiful things because now when the ants rebuild the whatever weird ant towers they were making, they've got all the experience from the last time and they're going to add the whatever novelty or inspiration is happening now, and they're going to add their experience to that and it'll be something even better.
That's the goal. That's the hope. That's the hope, is to go make something new and different and bigger, or learn, having learned, and, you know, that's the goal.
How do you have something planned?
I don't. I don't. I have a couple now. I have a couple, like, movie ideas and TV ideas that I'm starting to ruminate with, but I wanted the mental space opened up to start to, because I'm not capable. There are certain people I've seen, I'm like, wow, you are making that show and you're fucking doing these three other things that are in development. Like, wow, that's amazing. Like, I have a certain amount of brain space.
Yeah.
And Kroll Show was taking up, I'd say, like 80 to 90% of my creative brain's power.
So what's your, now that you have a clear schedule,
yeah,
what does your day look like? How much time do you spend writing or sort of throwing out fishing lines to figure out what the next thing's going to be?
I don't know. I mean, as we were saying before we started, I was like, somehow the free days seem more stressful than the full days, in that you're like, shit, I have to accomplish these three things. Like, I just went and got like the TSA pre-check thing done. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like, I'm like, shit, like that, I went and then I forgot
my
passport.
Where do you go to do that?
Close by here.
No shit. Yeah. I thought you had to go to fucking LAX.
You have to go to LAX if you want the international one. If you just, I mean, which I would probably eventually get. But for this is like for domestic, it's like, it's in Glendale.
So you go to Glendale.
Yeah.
And then they interview?
And then I don't have my passport. And so I have to go home and get it and come back. they interview you. They fingerprint you. They
interview you.
They don't really – I mean, you fill out a bunch of stuff beforehand. It's very simple.
They don't ask you cool questions?
No. It's like – but they – you fill out stuff ahead of time, being like, have you been convicted of a crime, or, you know, that kind of stuff, you know? So then it's that kind of stuff, and then they fingerprint you, and there you go.
You know, my friend Ari – you know Ari Shaffir,
yeah.
He says – you shouldn't buy your rights back. Like, he doesn't want to
– sure.
You know,
oh, I think it's very – when I walk through the airport, it's like it's a real class thing. It's a real class thing to be like, I have the time and the money to pay so that I don't have to fucking wait with the
How much was it?
It was $85.
If you have a TSA pre-check and you're traveling with somebody, do they get to go through pre-check?
No.
See, that sucks. You got to be a solo traveler, because what are you going to do, leave your buddy in the dust while you go parading through the Prince line?
But it is nice if you're a comedian. It is nice. It's like, it's nice to be like, oh, I don't have to take my shoes off anymore at the airport.
Yes, and that is just brutal, man. It really. It's not just the. It's just the general, like, yeah, like
it's
now.
I mean, take your belt off. It's demeaning. There's something very demeaning about all of that.
Very demeaning.
And also, I plan my outfits for travel based on the 2 minutes before I get on a plane, before I go through security, and the 2 minutes afterwards. Like, I need shoes that I can slip on very fast, so that I'm not. And you're like, it's 2 fucking minutes. But yet I'm like, no, I got to wear that. I got to wear that sweatshirt because I can stuff all the shit in my pockets so that I can stuff it in the bag and put, you know, and you're like, it's just, it doesn't make any sense.
These glum shit bags, that's the other thing, man. It's like, they're so glum. Like, you have to go through this. They know, they're just, you know, like when you have to throw your water away.
Mm-hmm.
That just happened. I don't care about my water, but like I threw the water away, and my friend's like, yeah, that's real dangerous. And the guy's like, Google search Hobby Gasibagi, the KAHs of, something like that. But
yeah.
That's cool, man. I mean, so your day now.
So my day is now, it depends on the day. Like right now, in these couple weeks, like right now is Kroll Show promo stuff. So a lot of my day is like doing a podcast or, you know, doing some sort of like online, you know, answering some, you know, Pitchfork wants to do something about the music or what, you know, things like that. And then, then it's also now, so my hope is like, I just need to schedule shit. I also write verbally. I write much better verbally than I do sitting down and writing.
So you record? You just record it into your phone?
Well, meaning that I like to write with people.
Oh, I
see. So like, I'll meet with a guy who I'm working on a script with. I'm going to go now sit with him and go to a coffee shop, talk about it, and then walk around. And like, out of that will hopefully be the next incarnation of the beginnings of an outline for a script.
Cool.
Movie script. And then like, stand up. Like, I'm going to go do a spot tonight, but I'll sit down probably for an hour and listen. Like, I've been trying to get my head wrapped around doing stand-up again, which is that's the thing I'm having trouble jump-starting. Because in doing Kroll Show the last few years, I haven't written a ton of new jokes. I mean, I have the hour that I can, but I don't want to go to a city I've been to and do the same hour.
Right.
So it's like, so it's starting again. So that is like now, like trying to fucking do you know, just like, but I write on stage. I don't know how you, what your process is of like writing jokes, but like.
I'll say something mildly funny and then I'll come on stage and realize that it wasn't funny at all.
That's how I've been feeling. So, or I'll listen, I do record my sets, so I'll go and listen to them and see what little nuggets I liked and try to expand on that. And then, what else? I mean, that's sort of the, I mean, so the days fluctuate in that way. I'm trying to like listen to more like podcasts that are informational in some way.
Yeah.
Or just, I'm just trying to absorb now. I'm trying to get back to absorbing useful media.
That's a huge part of writing, is making sure that you have some kind of input that isn't solely the internet. Because I know my shit dries up quick if I'm just like doing the Reddit, Huffington Post, whatever loop. Yeah. That will dry the field so fast.
Yeah, my goal this year, my big New Year's resolutions is like, my big New Year's resolution is like just scale back on like, scale back on booze, pot, food, and my phone.
Yeah.
Because all four of those, I feel in some level, like I feel a slave to all four of those.
Now, here's an interesting, you know, I've been telling a lot of friends, a lot of people are, the phone resolution is a big one right now. Because we're all kind of realizing like, oh, this is as much of an addiction as any other thing.
Oh, shit, yeah.
But it's like, you know, man, that. So there's a Buddhist concept, which is movement masks suffering. Movement masks pain. And it's like, if you just start becoming mindful of why you're looking at your phone, why you're drinking the booze, why you're – it's a really interesting idea, which is – and you were hitting on it earlier, which is the concept that every comedian kind of feels the same way regardless of where you are on the totem pole. There's still a general sense of someone's a pain that comes from wanting to be at another tier, you know, that is suffering from longing for that thing. And then Buddhism, that concept gets stretched out over all things, which is just basically like we are on a bed of nails, and the attempt and what a lot of people are doing in their careers or jobs or anything or pleasure seeking is trying to take the nails and rearrange the configuration of nails on the bed of nails that we're laying on with the delusion that if we get the nails in just the right pattern, they'll stop hurting as they pierce our flesh. Truth of the matter is, it doesn't matter which configuration of nails that you have in this existential torture device that you're laying on, you're still going to be suffering. So when you start applying that idea to and you'll begin to realize like, shit, man, I'm looking at my phone or drinking this shit or eating too much or smoking weed or doing whatever it is that I'm doing generally because I have this idea that it's going to reduce my anxiety.
Right.
But if you really start paying attention to your anxiety states as you look at your phone, as you smoke weed or drink or eat too much or whatever, you realize, shit, it's the exact same before and after.
Yeah.
No change.
Right.
And so then you realize, oh, what I'm doing is just kind of a pathetic flailing in the face of oblivion to try to just it's a sort of temper tantrum involving all this shit.
Have you thought about making a show called or a band called Existential Torture Device?
I have now. Make it your next project,
that's
Kroll.
It. That's the
Make
one.
It your next project.
How are we doing?
We it's 2:04.
Okay, you've we're got in good a, shape. We're
okay,
good shape.
Cool. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about how you make a character. You have these great fucking characters, man, and they're so they're so like nuanced, and you're so fully that thing. How do you do that? I'm always fascinated by that process.
How do I do that? I think it's I mean, I think it's I'm more and more I think about like family constellation, like where you're born in your family. And I'm the youngest of four, and there's a combination of things that happen. I think when you're the youngest in certain, I mean, I can't speak for all families, but my family is that you're naturally, everyone is charmed by you because you're the youngest and they all feel like they have some part in the creation of you.
Right.
You know what I mean? They're like, he's so funny. It's like, cause you taught him that joke, you know, and now he's delivering it.
Yeah.
And also you're around people all the time and you're just observing stuff. You know, so I think as the youngest, oftentimes you get to just sit and watch everything going on. Whereas if you're the oldest, you're like either you are rebelling wildly against where your parents, or you are trying to placate and make sure that everything in the house is moving smoothly, right, and that you are the one who is like, you are the one who's like, look, I know the kids are a lot, but I'm going to be the one who helps you through this, you know.
The peacemaker.
Yes. And or they go the other way. Right. You know what I mean? Or they be like, I'm going to go light toilet paper on fire in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And show all the other kids because I don't want to deal with the pressure of being the little adult.
Right.
So I think the youngest oftentimes gets to just sit there and like all of your friends, your siblings have friends over and you just watch. You're just observing everything. So I think that it started in some capacity for me there. And I think it's a lot of it is of constantly observing people and their mannerisms. And then it really was helpful in New York being able to ride the subway. Like the thing I miss most about New York is the subway. I miss the public life of New York. Yeah. I miss that a lot. I think LA is obviously has a lot of advantages, but you're in your car, you're in your home, you're in pods, like you're alone. And so when I moved to LA, a lot more of my inspiration for characters came from TV or from the internet of being like, I'm interested in that kind of guy. And then you watch, you know, a YouTube clip of whatever. I was doing Bobby Bottle Service before Jersey Shore, but then Jersey Shore comes on and you just get to watch, even if it's a manufactured reality that they're dealing with, their natural state and way of talking and manners are coming through. So you just start to take note and, you know, it's like, so I think it's like, I think I think everybody has like a song. And so like the great, this is a different thing, but like the great comedians, you like their song.
Right.
Like Chris Rock, like I've seen Chris Rock do sets at like the Cellar right after 9/11 and he's doing jokes, but he's not doing his song. He's just seeing if the jokes work.
Right.
And he's working on it and he's talking like this. I mean, he's talking like Chris Rock, but he's talking like this. What a blah, 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 blah. Because he's like, I know if I put on the song, people will laugh.
Whoa.
You know what I mean? So then eventually when the jokes are there, then he starts singing.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think everybody has their song and you're just trying to learn people's songs.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally, man. That's really cool.
I haven't quite expressed it like that, so I'm enjoying the idea of it.
That's right, badass. Yeah.
So I think like so I think that's part of it, and then it's like, and then really it's like putting together a team of people who you trust and like, who can both writers. I oftentimes now a lot of my characters I've ended up collaborating with other people on. So it's whether it's like Oh Hello, the Upper West Side guys, me and John Mulaney, or it's Publicity with me and Jenny Slate, or you know, Rich Dix with me and John Daly.
Yeah.
I oftentimes have a partner who exists in that world, and we sort of can play off of each other and create a language that unto themselves.
But
you know?
When you – what's the – like Rich Dix, what's the first time you guys did that? Or did you do it by yourself? Or
I saw John Daly do – he on stage one night, he did this thing, Wendy Shawn. He played a guy named Wendy Shawn, which is still his character's name. Wendy Shawn, who doesn't have a care in the world, I think was like the full title of it. And he was just like he was a rich dick. And he and I were buddies and had been working together. And I saw afterwards, I was like, dude, I've been circling around, having grown up with these kids and gone to college with these kids and been in New York and observed these people. Like, not saying I'm beyond, like, I was in the middle of some of those people. Who are friends of mine, but I just was, and he crystallized it, and I was like, we gotta fucking do these guys. Like, well, let's go make something with these guys.
Cool.
And so we started going on hikes and talking about what it could be and formulating some world of what it was, and then met with John Kreisel, who I was connected to and was like, I have this idea with my buddy John. It's this thing called Rich Dix. And he's like, got it. Like he knew, because he also knew some of those guys, and then we started to make it, and it continues to evolve. But that was really Daly did it first. I saw what he was doing, and it was like, you know, it was like that song that you're like,
yeah,
how does it go again? You're like, yeah, that's it, that's right, I remember now. And that was sort of the basis for that character.
Is there a feeling that when you're doing these characters, is it how much of it is a feeling? Like how much of it is like is the like if there's a compass leading you in the direction of what they do, is there a feeling that goes along with it?
It's a combination of things. I mean, it's like for me, it's a huge thing, as I was saying, like the team of people you work with, both the people like I perform with, but then also like the wardrobe people. Like once I get into wardrobe and makeup, like and I'm wearing those people's clothes, like it's a cheesy thing that they're like, you know, it's like actors are like, I need to be wearing the character's shoes.
Right.
Which sounds sort of cheesy, but then it's like, no, man.
Makes sense.
Fucking dress like that. You dress like Bobby Bottle Service in like a tight shirt. Then it's like the shoulders come back and you're fucking peacocking and you're Bobby Bottle Service. You know what I mean? Like it's that you feel it. You feel that you feel you're wearing the jewels. You're wearing like the fucking ring he wears. And all of a sudden your hands are like you're expressing your hands with your pinky out because you've got that fucking big ass ring on your hand. You know what I mean?
So like so cool.
You start to inhabit it that way.
That is so badass, Nick. Because do you know why? Because everybody's doing that. This is what's so crazy. Everyone's wearing the clothes of this certain character that they think is who they are. And they don't realize that if you were just change what you were wearing or just shift or alter some aspect of yourself, you would probably turn into some new thing.
Yeah, or there are the people who are shapeshifters who are constantly changing. Like their existence is the ephemeral nature of whatever look they're taking on.
Oh, wow.
Do you know what I mean? Like there are people like that who like every couple weeks, like every – there's a couple people in our world who I'm like every couple months I'm like, oh, you got a new look now.
Whoa, that's so funny. Shit, man. I wish we could talk forever. You got a meeting coming up in 3 minutes, so we got to end this, Nick. Where can people find you? People are going to want to watch your show. Or people already watched. They already know the show. But dude,
it's Comedy Central, 10:30 Tuesday nights after Tosh. And it'll be – yeah, it's starting January 13th. And runs through, you know, there's 11 episodes. I really like, I will say this about the show, as we were talking about ending it, like the reason I felt comfortable ending it is because all the stories and characters and worlds that we created start to collapse and collide into one another.
Cool.
I mean, not in every sketch, but like a lot of it starts to really mold and you know,
so the show has this awareness of its own collapse, is what you're saying? Like the characters
certain episodes you'll see, like you'll, you know, certain episodes will start with a character in one world, she'll get in a publicity, she gets in a fight, she leaves, she ends up in a gold digger show, you know, like another kind of reality show with Mantzoukas and Seth Morris playing different characters, you know, these gold digger characters. Then those gold digger characters like leave and end up in a new show, which is like a, you know, meanwhile, the Oh Hello guys have left New York. They prank Henry Rollins.
Wow.
He leaves them on the side of the road. They then, I mean, it's like
that's badass.
Certain shows like that all start to, it becomes this like multi-genre narrative of one story.
That's fucking cool, man. I can't wait to watch that.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, man. Thanks. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, no, the last thing I'll say is that the season three, if you haven't seen the show, seasons one and two are on the Comedy Central app. They're on Hulu, iTunes, and Amazon Prime right now, and the DVDs. So if you haven't watched the show, watching seasons one and two will give you the background for all the characters and storylines so that if you watch season three, you'll appreciate all of it that much more.
Great. I'll have all those links at DuncanTrussell.com in the comment section of this podcast. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Nick Kroll.
Duncan, I appreciate
I'll see you around. Thanks. Bye. I'll see you around. Thanks. Bye. That was Nick Kroll, everybody. Follow him on Twitter. Watch his show. Go through our Amazon portal. Love yourselves. Sit by a warm fire. Go to a spa. Massage your grandmother's feet. Give us a nice rating on iTunes. And come see a live DTFH if we come anywhere near where you happen to live. See you next time. Hare Krishna.